Today, let's amble about on a patriotic path for a minute or two.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
Or 45 minutes, by the way. So we'll see how long this takes. I don't go down this path very often anymore because there's just so many ways to fall off the cliff in the conversation. I haven't found it helpful lately. But this one, I think, will be helpful. July has passed. We're moving on from it. And July is a pretty patriotic month. I mean, the focus on July 4th and all the things that follow and the heat of summer and the American, you know, nostalgia for American pie and baseball and all that, makes us think of, at least it makes me think of, in the way I grew up, a lot of patriotic themes and ideas. So I have given it time and let it digest and process in myself so that I can communicate, hopefully a little more clearly, the reasons that I love America. And I hear this statement all the time. I love America. I love being American. I love being a patriot and so on. And, you know, what I want to ask sometimes is the same thing that a young bride might ask her, you know, her groom at times when he says, oh, I love you. And her response is, why? You know, and if you've been in a relationship very long, eventually, you know, people ask that. That's my experience. So why? And part of it is just to be cute and fun and, you know, give me some reasons, you know, name some of the things that make you love me. And then, you know, then you're always hunting for what the answer is. And then you're trying to enumerate details about the person, and sometimes it's not all that impressive trying to get there. And I could think of examples, but they're embarrassing, so I'm not going to go there. And sometimes, you know, a young husband might be able to display some impressive rhetorical skills, or maybe have fewer rhetorical skills and not be very impressive with it. But then other times, you know, you can think of examples of all those things. I mean, there's a famous short story. I can't remember what it is. I mean, maybe I'll be able to look it up and put a reference to it somewhere. But of a man trying to tell his young bride why he loves her so much and compares her to a watermelon he wants to break over his knee. You know, you look so fresh and, you know, all that kind of stuff. It's like, yeah, that's not a great way to describe how much you love someone. That's a fail. And then, you know, there are others that are magnificent, that are beautiful. I'll share one in a moment from Elizabeth Barrett Browning, the most obvious and famous one. I think it's a useful tool for us today as we talk about this. But anyway, sometimes that question, you know, why? Why do you love me? And here we're talking about the country in particular. Oh, yeah. Why are you so patriotic? Why do you love the country so much? You know, it's an opportunity for reflecting on what it is that created in that relationship with the other person such an attraction for that particular human being. Oh, yeah, let me think about that. What is it? What is it that makes me love you so much, you know? And with the country, I think it'd be the same kind of question. The poem, obviously, by Elizabeth Barrett Browning I'm talking about that comes to mind is, you know, the one that starts out, how do I love thee? Let me count the ways, you know, what are the ways that we actually love someone? And there are answers to that question. How do I love thee? How is it that I love you? What is it that I would say? Well, this is why I love you. There are answers to that question that may be meaningful and important, but they're not all that interesting. Well, you know, first of all, you're a woman. Okay, well, that helps a lot. So anybody could basically fill that role. But it's also true. It is also part of the picture. So there are answers to this question about patriotism and why we love our country so much and why we want to stand up and pledge the flag and all those kinds of things that are important and they are meaningful, but they're not what I want to talk about today. So, let's start there for just a second to sort of get it out of the way. There are legitimate or meaningful answers to this question that are not the focus for today. These are the answers that this just has to do with the personal approach I want to take to answering the question today. These would be the answers that are not necessarily distinct from what anyone would say about their own country, even if it's not America, and I'm using America because that's the language we use all the time for our country, the United States of America. I know there are other countries on the American continent, but, I'm talking about it as a United States citizen today, as an American today. And so that's how we talk about it most of the time. So let me pass with that one, okay? These answers are not necessarily distinct, even though they're meaningful. They're not the answers I want to give today, not what I want to talk about today, because they're not distinct from what someone would say about why they love their country, why they love Russia, or why they love Mexico, or why they love Canada, or why they love whatever. They're still important. Like, I love America because that's where my mom taught me how to be, whatever it is I've become. Whether you think that's good, bad, or indifferent, it is what she taught me to be, and so on. I love America because of the food. I love steak and potatoes, being king, here. I love barbecue or whatever it is you love about the food in America. But people can say that about their own country. They love their, in fact, I was talking to, here on this podcast, on a previous episode with Luis Juarez, who was in here talking about his home country of Nicaragua and how he loves America, loves to be here, but he also loves food from his home country. And so do I, so I understand why he would say that. It doesn't make it unimportant. It doesn't make it meaningless. It is a part of why I love America, but it's not distinct about this particular country in the same way that topography and geography is that way. I can say I love the purple mountain majesties above the fruited plains and actually understand what that means. Apparently a reference, by the way, to Pikes Peak. I don't care that it's that particular mountain. I'm just saying, I do love the mountains, and I do love the fruited plains, the grain in the fields of Kansas, whatever. I love all of that, but, so do other people who love the rills and the rivers of their country, or the mountains and crevices of their country, or the valleys and the plains of their country, or the, whatever the distinctive geographical features are. Which are, again, beautiful and meaningful and important. And I love these particular topographies. I love the deserts of West Texas. So I love all of that about America, but it's not the thing that makes my love for my country particularly American. So my own answers that I want to give today, that, again, it's kind of a personal episode today. I mean, if you'll just hang with me for a few minutes. I think parts of it are worth engaging with for something more than just about me or my personal experience. But my own answers are here given in the context of what made me come to love America as a boy and then a young adult, a young man. And there are things that still make me love our country. They make me love America. And these things still sometimes make me weak-kneed in awe at the uniquely American reality of our social contract, our existence as a nation state. I want to say nation, but that word is weighted, having to do sometimes with race, having to do sometimes with social order, and a variety of things. And it's not that. It's just this whole social experiment that is America that I'm talking about. And at other times, sometimes I'm shaken to my core about whether my beloved country is as unshakable as I believed it to be when I was younger. And so what I want to do is take that you know, that poem. this is ridiculous. I think it's ridiculous, and I'm doing it. But I do want to take that poem because that line, you know, struck me immediately when I wanted to talk about why I love my country. Because so often I hear people say that, I love my country, I'm so patriotic, you know, whatever. And they're not, you know, I just don't think they're thinking in the moment about why. And so I want to stop them and say, why? Why? Why do you love the country? And is what you're promoting, what you're doing right now, actually out of love for that, for what you're saying you love about America? So if I'm going to ask that question, then I need to ask it of myself. So I wanted to ask myself the question, but why? Which forced me to the first line of that poem, you know, in a sort of silly way. Yeah, how do I love thee? Why do I love you as a country? Let me count the ways. So I looked up the poem, make sure I'd get the line exactly right, and started reading through the poem, and it's like, those are the reasons I love the country. Even though, obviously, Elizabeth Barrett Browning, I mean, we're talking about a romantic poet at the end of the 19th century with, you know, her husband, Robert Browning, Robert and Elizabeth Barrett Browning, you know, they're huge. I mean, I learned their poetry when I was in college and, you know, love a lot of the things they write. Didn't really learn to appreciate how excellent it was as poetry until I was much older. But I do now. And anyway, in reading through the rest of her poem, knowing that it's about, you know, it's really about, I think it's supposed to be read in the context of an individual. Poems are always ambiguous. There's always more to them. But this one's not about patriotism. It's not about the country. And yet it's a perfect fit for talking about the things that actually make me love America, make me love our country, and also make me long for certain things in our country that I have loved. In the same way. And so I just want to read it in that context. So that poem that she gives, where she talks about why she loves someone, how do I love thee? Let me count the ways. I love thee, she says, to the depth and breadth and height my soul can reach when feeling out of sight for the ends of being an ideal grace. And I know that there's a lot to unpack in that, but I'm not trying to do poetry today. Maybe we'll come back and do it another day. I love thee to the level of every day's most quiet need by sun and candlelight. That range, just before we get to the first phrase that I want to focus on, is one of the reasons that I love America. But that range does hit at sometimes the depth of sense that we have for desire for our country, for being a part of a nation that's actually beautiful and worth serving. You know, that idea. To the depth and breadth and height my soul can reach when feeling out of sight for the ends of being an ideal grace. Being, you know, the actual living in the world, opposite of how Plato would use it, by the way. But being and then ideal grace, the nature of the perfection of giving that we would experience as well. And yet I'm finally experiencing that in this occasion. You know, how can I actually apply that? And so anyway, I think there are three sides to this from me that make that, you know, patriotism or love for the country clearest for me to express. One is in the line she gives next in the poem, I love thee freely as men strive for right. And it's interesting. I mean, the words are just begging to be applied to this question. I love thee freely as men strive for right. I grew up loving American freedom. And freedom isn't something that everyone in the world loves. Now, again, I don't mean by that not everyone wants to do what they want to do. They do. But I do mean by that a lot of times when people talk about political freedom, they don't mean the same thing we mean. And we say it confusedly. We put together two different ideas in the same concept. So to clarify, I'm not just talking about the liberty of not being ruled by another country. I am grateful for that, but not the same way I'm grateful for the freedom I'm talking about today, my personal liberty. I'm grateful for the freedoms that we celebrate as a nation in the way we practice our political rule. This part of liberty, the part I'm talking about that I'm not focused on today, this part of liberty, the part where, you know, we're not ruled by another country, we are free, we're not ruled over by, you know, King George in England. You know, I know that he's not still there, but you get the point I'm talking about in the revolution. This part of liberty where we're not ruled over by another country, I sort of grasped when I was, I think, 9, 10 years old. I can't remember which occasion it was. that this end of the Vietnam War was going, you know, because there's the Paris Accords and then there's finally the fall of Saigon, and those happened 2 or 3 years apart from each other. I don't even remember exactly when, 1973 or something to 1975, somewhere in there between being 10 and 12 years old. I was riding the back seat of the car with my mom driving on the turnpike. That tells you the era when this was happening. For those of you who are from the Dallas-Fort Worth area, you know what I mean by the turnpike, what became I-30 later when we were still paying 25 and 50 cent tolls on the turnpike. Anyway, and I mean, you had to stop and throw a quarter into the whatever the machine was, or hand it to a person. Anyway, we were riding on the turnpike, and the radio was playing, and it was talking about Americans coming home from Vietnam. And I'd, you know, my whole conscious life to that point, there had been a Vietnam War. That was just a background noise for my life. And it, you know, it finally dawned on me in that moment. And I had thought the question before, but to ask someone and say, why do we get to fight our wars somewhere else? You know, why don't we fight here? And that, as many answers as there are to that question and all the things you might want to talk about regarding colonialism and imperialism and all that stuff in this moment, that's not the point I want to make today. My point is simple, that I fully realized in that moment, again, I still remember looking out at the trees that were passing by the car while I was having this thought, how blessed we are not to have wars in our backyard, not to wonder if someone's coming across the border with their tanks next week or something, that we are, as a country, blessed in that way. But that's not what makes me love America uniquely. That's not the kind of freedom that I want to talk about, although that freedom is a blessed freedom we have. You know, let me give a parallel to what I'm talking about today, the kinds of freedoms, the kinds of reasons that I'm talking about today for why we love things and why it's a little difficult for us to grasp this. Because the freedom I do want to talk about, personal liberty, that I want to talk about in just a moment, which is one of the three reasons that I love America, that I love being American. The reason I think we get trapped and lose our sense of what we really mean by it, and then end up saying, I love America, but we end up actually loving the things that are the opposite of what we should love about America or what we actually do love about America. We end up embracing other things is because it's a little confusing for us. There's this sort of built-in irony to life that I want to explain with a parallel discussion, not about America, not about patriotism for a moment, but just an example of how this is. It is common that what we say we prefer, and in this case, love, you know, that what we say we want actually isn't what brings us what we do, really do prefer or want about, you know, whatever it is that we're talking about. So, you know, as an example for me, this is an example I've used before, but ages ago. I love the fact that no one else uses the trails that I ride my bike on. So when I'm riding my bike and there's a bunch of people, I don't get to ride full speed and I have to be cautious and I have to tell people, bike on your left. And, you know, it's just, you know, who knows? So I'm still glad to get to ride and I'm okay with the fact that they're there. But when no one's there, I'm riding around like king, man. This is how the world ought to be. You know, there's a trail that's just for Barry Creamer to ride his bike without having to worry about anybody else or whatever. That all sounds reasonable, but in reality, that doesn't work. No one's going to maintain a trail if I'm the only person who rides on it. In fact, I'd have to maintain it, and I don't want to go out and maintain a trail and ride on it. I just want to ride on it. And if there are no other people using a trail, that's just not going to happen. The fact that other people use it is what's going to make it so nice for me to be on eventually anyway. And, you know, this, and by the way, I recognize that most of the ironies I use as examples, they sort of come out of a unique feature, well, not unique, a particular feature about me. It's true that the most obvious or naturally observable ironies for me derive from the dual nature inherent to being, you know, human, I am, which makes me inherently socially dependent. Human beings are social beings by nature. And I am introverted, which is inherently to feel uncomfortable when depending on other people or a society. So a lot of my ironies come from the fact that I'm an introvert, but there would be the same kind of ironies for extroverts or for anybody else. I'm just picking the ones that are most obvious for me to make the point. And we do that same thing with personal liberties, as an example. So when I say I love American freedom, we can run into some confusing ideas about it. So, you know, what? And this is what I do mean today. I love America, first reason, because of personal liberty, because of freedom. As a kid, I remember seeing all the weird things people were doing in other parts of the country. And I grew up in the 60s, so it was weird, man. I mean, there were people doing weird things, right? So I remember seeing all of that stuff. And, by the way, seeing how weird they thought what we were doing in the South was, and loving the fact that we just kept letting each other be different. You know, I mean, yeah, there were conflicts. We would see the conflicts, but you would suppress the conflict to allow the differences to continue. And I loved that. I loved that as a kid. I love American freedoms. I really do. The fact that we weren't willing to adopt our Constitution without a Bill of Rights to ensure that the government that we were creating wouldn't just trample over the individuals who created it so that they wouldn't be trampled over by the society they were already a part of. We create a government so we won't be trampled over by other people. We weren't willing to create a government that would keep us from being trampled over by other people that wasn't willing to commit itself to not trampling over us as well. I love that about our country, that we thought through all those layers of personal freedom and protected them at that layer, at that level. In fact, you know, in Hobbes's Leviathan, Thomas Hobbes, he writes this thing, The Leviathan, that makes this point about why we embrace the power of a government, why we endorse the power of a government, and the commitment we make to each other in doing that. It's part of his social contract theory. And the Leviathan is the government. So what he describes here as one man is really, you know, the person who represents the full force of the government. If you're under a monarchy, you think of the government as that man, for instance, as the king, or so on. But it's also an assembly, like parliament for him. So I'm going to read you this section. It'll take just a minute. But I want you to understand this part from Thomas Hobbes so you can understand what I mean by the celebration of the liberties that we have. So it says, you know, the way we erect a common power to defend from, because we have to have more power than an individual has to keep us safe from foreign armies, for instance, or from whatever the power of other masses of people might be. So the way we erect that, the way we choose to create that government so that we can protect our interest in the fruits of the land and all the other things that come from being together, people will confer all their power and strength upon one man or upon an assembly of men, a government, a parliament, that may reduce all their wills by plurality of voices under one will, which is as much to say to appoint one man or assembly of men to bear their person. So suddenly they become the thing that can tell us what we're going to do, and everyone, so we respect a government, and everyone to own and acknowledge himself to be the author of whatsoever he that so beareth their person shall act or cause to be acted in those things which concern the common peace and safety, and therein to submit their wills, everyone, to that one will, the government's will, and their judgments to that one judgment, the government's judgment. This is more than consent or concord. It is real unity of them all in one and the same person, made by covenant of every man with every man in such manner as if every man should say to every other man in the society, this is the quote, get this, I authorize and give up my right of governing myself to this government, to this man or this assembly of men, on this condition, that you also give up your right to him and authorize all his actions in like manner. That is, as a group, we come together and are willing to embrace the authority the government has over us to limit our personal freedoms, as long as everybody's limiting their personal freedoms in exactly the same way, that we all recognize the equality that we have under this government. This done, he says, the multitude so united in one person is called a commonwealth, in Latin, the civitas. The commonwealth means it's for everybody's benefit. That's the whole point of it. So the will to give up those personal liberties under that kind of social order entails that everyone else agree to give up the exact same liberties. I loved that. When I was growing up and I finally realized how all that was working together, it's like, this is like calculus that just automatically forms itself on the page. It just sort of makes itself work. That is, so everyone's willing to give up some personal liberties, their personal liberties, the personal liberties which would have prevented us from having that kind of society. And that kind of society, this kind of society, is the one that actually gives us greater freedom under the constraints of social agreement, because the social agreement gives us security and prosperity and specialization, whatever, than the freedom we could only have had in isolation from everyone else. Because everyone else brings benefits and we want them. So, or we could have only have had in an authoritarian control of everyone else, in which case freedom's no longer valued in itself at all. Only my own selfish desires would be valued in that kind of system. And that's not what I celebrate about America. What I loved was the difference of people who all came together, and even though they wanted completely different things for themselves, agreed the way to get there was to let everybody pursue the best they could the interests they had as individuals. America's not great because everyone has to go to the same enormous, powerful church. The thing I love about it is that it's great because it's free, meaning everyone gets to go or not go to whichever large or small, loud or quiet, experiential or intellectual, functional or dysfunctional church they want. That is, freedom in itself is important. Not just selfishness. That's the trick. What loving freedom cannot mean is this. It cannot simply mean that I love being able to do whatever I want. That's what we think of in a shallow level, sort of like, well, I want a trail all to myself. No, you really don't. That's not what you want. It doesn't mean, oh, being able to do whatever I want to do. It doesn't. It sounds the same, but it is, in fact, the opposite. Because one person or one group being able to do whatever they want doesn't require any political freedom at all. That's related to what's coming next, by the way, we'll talk about in the line, men who turn from praise, that is, men who don't want the power that they have. If all you want is to do what you want to do, you can be in an authoritarian society. I love America because I'm king. That's not the same thing as loving freedom. What I love about America is that it's not just we get to do whatever we want to do. That's not it. What I love about America is the freedom that says, I love the fact that my freedom is distributed to everyone. It's mine and theirs, and that means they get to do stuff I don't like and I get to do stuff they don't like, and we're all maximizing how free we are as individuals. I loved that when I was growing up. I loved it as a young man. I still love it now when we recognize that that's what freedom is. So let me add to it the next layer so we don't run out of time talking about all three of these. The next layer is this line from Elizabeth Baer Browning's poem. Again, I know it's ridiculous to use her poem, but here we are. I love thee purely as they turn from praise. So that statement, you know, I mean, it's a beautiful line in the poem. They that turn from praise, she doesn't say the word that, but it's, you know, it's the implication. I love thee purely as they turn from praise, meaning it's not just selfish. I actually love you. Men turning from praise means they receive praise and they turn away from it. No, it's not about me. This is not about me. Don't raise me up. That turning from praise idea is what I'm talking about. The humility described in that line of her poem translates perfectly into political selflessness. The political selflessness I saw portrayed even when individual men violated its example. And I know, I want to say individual men and women, but the truth is, I didn't see a whole lot of women in political power violating the example of political service when I was growing up. Maybe that was because I didn't see very many women in political power when I was growing up. So we can talk about that another day, different topic. But I do mean, I loved the humility I got to see in so many of the powerful people I saw exercising their political power. I'm not naive. I know there's an opposite side to that. We'll talk about it in a minute. We'll get there in just a moment. with the destruction of those perfect ideals that we had that she talks about in the next line of her poem. But in this part, when I was growing up, I did see a lot of that humility. There are always, I know, I understand, there are always selfish, ambitious people in politics. It's inherent in the nature of the power that's associated with political leadership. People who don't want power don't run up and go, put me in charge. I want to be in charge. I want to run everyone else's life. That's not what happens. So the nature of political power is that, of course, it's going to attract the interest of people who want to exert power over other people. So there's always going to be, there are always going to be unscrupulous, ambitious, selfish people who are pursuing political power. It would just be absurd not to think that's going, where would they go if they don't go there? But there are also, and in American politics, which is the, those are the politics I've experienced and seen, there are also public servants. Legitimate public servants, people who really want to do whatever's best for the world around them. Later, I'll read to you a section from Plato, if we have time, that makes this point about public servants. Throughout my childhood and my young adulthood, I saw over and over again the commitment not to wield power at all cost, but in fact to turn away from power when it jeopardized the structures put in place to keep those who did want power from abusing it. That, you know, this, I mean, the things we learned as school kids, the separation of powers and the balance of powers, the reality that there was this, you know, equation built into the Constitution that said neither the executive nor the legislative nor the judicial branch can be in charge by itself, can run the country by itself. It just can't happen. The legislative branch is passing the laws and managing the money, and the judicial branch is reviewing what's going on in the legislative and the executive branches, and the executive branch is appointing the judicial branch and executing the laws that are enacted by the legislative branch, and there's an accountability with all three layers so that each layer is responsible. I mean, they're not layers. You know, each of the divisions, these separations of powers, is responsible for reviewing and holding in check the other powers that are present. And all of that, I mean, it's not perfect. Obviously, someone can exert power in a way that abuses it and so on. And somebody could get away with it because somebody's not doing the checks or exercising the balance of power in the right way. Obviously, all human institutions are flawed and fallible and can fail. I recognize all of that, but built into the design of it is this political statement from the people that is, we don't want power used for the sake of power. We want it checked no matter what. We don't want to see the same things here in America that have been true throughout world history in the abuse of power that's always happening. And again, does that mean it can never happen? No. We've all seen the abuse of power that happens at the local level sometimes and sometimes at the national level. We've all seen that. I know it's not perfect, but just the fact that we wanted to create a structure that would prevent that made me love this country. What a cool thing we have in place to put in check all the corruptions that can come into political power. Most frequently, that visibility of public service, of, you know, people who turned from praise, who were lauded by the crowds that elected them and put them into positions of power. The fact that they turned away from keeping that power at all cost for themselves, most frequently for me, and this, I mean, all of us saw this growing up like I did, it took the form of the peaceful transfer of power. It was really impressive. And if you weren't there for the 60s, you don't have a real sense of just how things felt like the country was about to fall apart. I mean, like we were going to split wide up. There would be another civil war. What's coming next? And yet, in the midst of all of that anxiety, I'm watching. LBJ is handing the controls over to Nixon. Nixon's handing them over to Ford. I know. Resignation, all that stuff. We'll talk about it in a minute. It's coming up. But Ford is handing over the reins to Jimmy Carter. And the, believe me, the political divisiveness then was just as entrenched. The belief that the country's fate hinged on every single election was just as present in that day as it is now. And yet, here's Ford handing over the reins to Jimmy Carter. And Jimmy Carter, with, you know, with total anxiety about what's going to happen if Ronald Reagan is actually elected president, if the Republicans gain control again, are we going back to the sort of bigotry and so on that was advocated for in the 1950s and 60s by these very same politicians who are now taking control of the government and so on. And yet Carter hands over the controls to Ronald Reagan. And when things are weird with Reagan, you know, in the end of his years, his long goodbye, you know, whether he's the same things that they were saying about Joe Biden at the end of his presidency, things were finally moved peacefully over to the first Bush, who became president. And Bush, despite all the fear of how it's going to destroy the country for a marijuana-smoking Bill Clinton to take the reins, Bush hands over the reins to Bill Clinton, and so on, all the way down the line. I loved the fact, as I was growing up and as I was a young man, that the public expected the people who were in power to shy away from using it. I'm not going to read you the section because we would run out of time, but in Plato's Republic, in book one of Plato's Republic, he does make this obvious argument, and it's a really plain-faced argument, that the best people to be in power politically are the people who don't want to do it. They don't want to do it because they're interested in more important things than government in their own lives and the values of eternal things. Or they're not interested in it because they don't want to use that office for their own benefit, which would be either thievery or just selling yourself out. And they don't want any of that. So the best people to rule are the people who don't want to rule. I love the fact that our country was set up to be like that, not to have a ruling class whose great desire is to be in power. I love the America that's served by people who want to shy away from the political obligations that sometimes force them into public service, that we don't want a ruling class, that the superiority we are looking for in our leaders isn't that they're powerful or that they have the right lineage or even their giftedness so much, but instead moral, not puritanical moral. I saw there was plenty of that. There's been plenty of that. But, you know, that part of the morality, you know, did they do everything right in their marriage? Have they got everything? All that stuff was always filtered by political party. If you were a Democrat, it was fine that Bill Clinton did what he did. And if you were a Republican, it was fine that Donald Trump did what he did. You know, it's always been that way. But I mean about moral fortitude, courage, temperament, even the humility of the candidate or the official, that's what we were looking for. That kind of person is who was idealized. And again, I'm not naive about it. There are always political leaders who wanted political power. What I love about America and what I loved about it when I was a young man was seeing how the public's expectations and how those structures of the government that I was talking about, the separation of power and so on, even of the divided layers of sovereignty, that there's a federal government and it's completely separate from the state governments, which are completely separate from the county and from the city and so on. They all forced even selfish politicians to play within the confines of the public interest over their own. Then the last line, by the way, that I want to pull out and say what I love about the country is her line, "I love thee with the passion put to use in my old griefs and with my childhood's faith." That is, when things fail, when I see things, you know, people do things wrong, even when government leaders are doing things wrong, I love the rule of law in America. I love what that means. That what actually unites us as a country isn't nationality or language or race or socioeconomics, but our agreement to abide by a constitution, by a written constitution, that we're not replacing every 30 days or 3 years like so many other countries, or just giving lip service to like so many other countries do. I love the fact that, and the whole weight of the rule of law is this indifference that it has to personality, to wealth, to class, and so on. And again, I'm not naive about it. I know classes have made a huge difference in the way law has been applied historically, but at least that's our goal, and therefore something that we're constantly correcting toward, and that's better than other places in the world. I love America because we have the rule of law as the ideal we want to obtain, and that we're always trying to move in that direction. That's where I want us to be. Nixon's resignation did that for me. I said I would bring this up later. I'm just going to mention it in passing. It's not like It's not like Richard Nixon did anything unpredictable. We knew who he was when he was elected. It's not like his humility drove him to resign. That never motivated anything for any of his life. And I'm not attacking him personally. I'm just saying everybody knows that's kind of who his person was. What I admired about that moment of Nixon's resignation, and it didn't shake me in the way it shook a lot of other people. What I loved about that moment was the fact, and I was 10 years old, I loved the fact that the political pressure forced Congress's hand to pressure the president of the United States into that resignation. What that served for me, for my 10-year-old self, it served as evidence of just how firmly established our commitment was to the rule of law. We still found our way back to doing things according to the Constitution. And that, you know, for a 10-year-old, that paid attention to politics, that was a moment of peace for me. I know it shook so many other people in the country so profoundly, but for a kid, it was a way of saying, oh man, the laws are in place. The people are in place who are going to enforce the laws, who are going to make it universal. And that's what makes this cool. Finally, by the way, the last lines in her poem, the things I'll close with, she says, I love thee with a love I seem to lose with my lost saints. You know, I lost all of these idealism, all these beautiful things, but I love thee with the breath, smiles, tears of all my life. And if God choose, I shall love thee better after death. Again, not trying to explicate her poem, just using it as a platform for making these comments about why I love America. For some of us, age makes our spirit more wizened than our soul wizened, if you know what I mean. And that's partially true about me. I'm a lot more jaded than I used to be. But I haven't given up. I believe I'm a Christian. I believe in the resurrection, for crying out loud. Anything can come to pass, and God can do all things. But I also am not pessimistic about where our country is. There is still a love for all of these things. The inherent truth of the matter is there are no places to go where we don't have to get along with people we disagree with. There's nowhere you can run and say, oh, but that place, I won't have to deal with the same kind of problem. In the world's history, this has been the best place to get along with those people without putting them all in prison or characterizing them all as enemies. The thing that characterized our grand experiment, in my mind, this is just a personal discussion today. It's about how I love America. The things that characterized our grand experiment, in my mind, were and are the emphasis that we have on personal freedom, which has cemented our commitment to the rule of law. These are not unrelated ideas. We have internal recourse when our freedoms are violated that are based in law. And in addition to that, how the rule of law has limited the exercise of political authority, because our political leaders have to follow the same rules we do. The rule of law has to be universal. We have internal recourse when those rulers don't. So we have stunted political corruption in a way I don't think anywhere else in the world has experienced at this level. It's impossible to avoid it completely. Wherever there's power, there's abuse. But where the rule of law is the priority, abuse is constantly constrained even when it does happen. And I love that about this. We're not perfect, but we try to get back to the ideal when we err from it, which is constantly. And finally, out of those three steps, you know, personal freedom leads to this commitment to the rule of law, which leads to this limitation on the exercise of political authority. And finally, I love how that balance, the government's power being limited by the value of universal personal freedoms, creates a society, in a society, people who are willing to defend that society even at the greatest costs. And I don't just mean by that soldiers. I do mean this by it, though. Not just, though, the soldiers and the first responders who risk their own safety for the security of that society. I am grateful for that. It's an unbelievable gift to us. But I also mean the lives and careers of every person who understands that what we give up in personal freedom for the sake of everyone else is worth it and more, precisely because what benefits everyone else's freedom is the best thing we contribute in the efforts we put into this really fine experiment in human history. I know our country's flaws. I'm not unrealistic about it. We've talked about them a million times on these episodes. That's one of our flaws, that we use hyperbole. I know the ones that we have, the flaws that we have, that have been with us since our inception. We've talked about them here. I know the ones we're multiplying right now with abandon. We've talked about those here too. But I also know the history that offers hope for our freedoms, for our rule of law, and for our public service. And in just that way, may God bless America.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.